record. Oh shit! This chair just broke again.
Damn! That's the one. Put it over there, and then I'll get glue for that one.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. It's Tuesday at 11:30 a.m. Welcome to Chatting Between Takes, Season 2, Special Drop: Conversations with My Father, who is Eugene Benson. Dad, how's it going today?
Very well. Lovely day. Look at the sunshine out there. Brilliant.
It's gorgeous.
Yep. Absolutely. All ready to roll.
And I'm looking at you right now, and you've got still one of the few orange trees remaining as we edge into winter. And it's a lovely photo. I actually posted it on my Instagram. A bit of a story for people to see. Mm-hmm. So what do you got on today, Dad? What do you got ahead of you?
What have I got ahead? I've got to go and see a musical today. Wonderful. I hear it's very, very good. Piaf and Dietrich. That's Edith Piaf, the wonderful French singer during the Second World War and after. And then Marlene Dietrich, the German legendary singer and actor, who was probably at that time, with Greta Garbo in her day, the two most famous actors in the world.
So going back through your life, did they have any actual impact, or were they just part of the landscape because they were famous?
Part of the landscape because they were famous. No, that was really it.
Not a big deal.
Not a big deal.
Okay, question for you that I want to start with. These are my questions right now, Dad. So I don't know if you keep up on Twitter or online, but there's two things happening in my sphere right now, and people who are listening will be part of that. One of them is that the ultimate insult you can make to somebody right now is, okay, boomer. Do you know what that means?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've caught up on that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Great. So let's talk about this. So baby boomers are considered out of touch right now.
Right.
They are the generation that basically says, why don't you just go get a job? And then millennials basically go, I don't think you understand, there aren't just jobs to go get. You don't just graduate with a college degree and go shake hands with the guy and now you've got a job and a pension. So what do you think about this idea? Do you think boomers, baby boomers, are out of touch? Do you think millennials should work harder? Do you have any opinions on that idea? Because okay, boomers, the biggest insult you can drop right now. When someone's like, why don't you just blah, blah, blah? Why don't you just get out of bed if you're depressed? Okay, boomer.
There's always been this. There's always been generational conflict. I think it's much freer nowadays. When I was growing up, the younger generations were there to be seen and not heard. I mean, that applied to children. That was the expression one day. But it was also this, very much the same way towards young people. So I think there's always been that when you go on to the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, that you were better than that generation that went before.
Sure.
More intelligent, standing for higher values, all that kind of thing, which, of course, is a lot of nonsense.
Go on about this, boomer.
Well, that's really all I have to say one.
Well, let me ask you this, though. Let's get specific.
Right.
You're 25.
Yeah.
You believe you have ideas that can change the world.
Yeah.
What is the generation, we'll call it two generations above, because again, I'm sure you know this, but you got your baby boomers, then you've got Gen X, then you got your millennials. Now, actually, to people listening, pardon me, Dad, while I divert, there's a whole lost generation in there. It's called Gen Y2K, and you can barely find evidence of this online, but that's actually what I am. Mm-hmm. I'm way too young to be Gen X, and I'm way too old to be a millennial. Mm-hmm. There's a Gen Y2K or the .com generation. That's sort of gotten lost in the mix, but you've got boomers, Gen X, millennials. Who were your boomers when you were 25? You wanted to change the world. You got the best ideas. Who's holding you back?
The only thing holding me back is myself. Because, you see, I think I'm puzzled by all these labels.
Mm-hmm.
The labels really are social media have brought in these labels. And for take your age, I mean, you say you don't fit into any of those. You are who you are, and you do what you can do.
Right.
And it doesn't matter whether you're a millennial, whether you're a baby boomer or a boomer.
Right.
These labels don't matter whatsoever.
So what matters?
Pardon?
What matters?
What matters is your own initiative, finding out your own track in life, the thing that you want to pursue, and not being tied up in labels. I mean, really, I
agree with you entirely, by the way. Yeah. I mean, I'm not just your son agreeing, because I'd happily disagree and do when I do. But I agree with you entirely. I think that sometimes these are excuses to not maybe do the thing. But I also do think there can be generations that simply don't understand that the wheel is turned, and let's say economically, there isn't job security the way you had.
Oh, that is for sure. I mean, the gutting of the middle class in terms of taking away pensions, taking away the rights of the workers, smashing unions, all of that thing is a total disgrace. And we've talked about this before in these podcasts. That's an economic crime in the very same way that I have some sympathy with Trump when he goes after China for stealing intellectual properties. The whole Midwest of the North American United States, we used to drive our family from, Buffalo right through to Albany, then down to Cape Cod when we were visiting there. And that was a wonderfully rich, diverse manufacturing century of the United States, and it was all gutted.
Sure.
Now, we blame that, as Trump does, on the foreigner, but it wasn't the foreigner. It was done by American industry itself.
Of course it was.
Billionaires of industries, the captains of industry, as they like to call themselves, and they were the ones who gutted it, because instead of being able to make $1 billion in mid-America, they could make $1.25 billion by taking away those jobs and giving them to other countries. So blaming it on other countries like China, Vietnam, etc., it wasn't their fault.
No, we wouldn't have economic relationships with them if we didn't want to.
And of course, the various schools of economic theory, they justified all this. They said it's good for America. Well, and these were the savants, the people with the PhDs, getting some of them being nominated for Nobel Prizes, that kind of level, talking absolute nonsense.
Absolute nonsense. Trickle-down economics has been proven to be utterly stimulates zero growth, whereas if you up the lower and middle classes' salaries, I think it's something ludicrously small, like 8 or 10%. Yeah. You stimulate growth by 20%, but no one will ever try that.
Well, as we mentioned before, it used to be in the 19th century that the boss, he would make 30, 40 times what the man on the floor worked or the woman on the floor. And now it is not unusual to find 2,000 times the salary of a worker that kind of thing, which is, I mean, it's an economic crime.
So let me ask you this then, Dad. It's an economic crime. The other topic that's been floated around a bunch in the last week or two is, should being a billionaire be essentially illegal? Should you have a billionaire?
Yes, I see no problem with having a billionaire, but I see no problem with taxing the billionaire up to, nowadays they talk about maybe we put 5% in there, 10%. This is nonsense. During the Second World War in England, the tax, you know what it was on the very rich? 90%.
Right.
Bernard Shaw got 10% of every $100 that came in. And he used to moan about that, but he said, well, that has to be done in order to help the working class, in order to keep Britain economically afloat, to save the country. And so there's nothing wrong with doing that. Well, the one great example with the billionaires is that they can float money back and forward, trading and so on, to put on a tax on every trade that is done on Wall Street would bring in untold billions of dollars and would not hurt in any way the billionaires.
No, it wouldn't.
And it sounds simplistic, but it's not simplistic. And very often in economics, it's the simple answers that really make sense.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely.
I totally agree. And I also think this idea, I can't speak to Britain during that wartime or post-war, but I know that people don't understand the marginal tax rate. Is that you're not taxed on dollar one at that amount.
No.
It's once you get above $400 million, now you're paying the extra thing.
Exactly.
And nobody's paying 60% tax on their first 30 grand, on their next 70 grand. It's only when you're getting up to those higher levels that that amount is taxed extra. And that's where I think a lot of people have been hoodwinked.
If you take Bloomberg at the moment, who's thinking of running for president of the United States, he's got about, they say, $50 to $70 billion.
Right.
Now, he's not going to be taxed on the first billion. But suppose you turn around and say, once he hits $45 billion, you're going to introduce a heavy tax there on him. Why not?
Sure.
Now, of course, you know what the answer will be? Communism. You're now taking away North American initiative, which is absolute nonsense. If he's made $50 billion, He's got 45 million there. What's wrong with that?
You know, I agree. Yep. Let's put it this way. I would love to be given $45 billion and then have people go, yeah, see how you like it. And I'm like, great, I'll take $10 billion and I'll distribute the rest. In fact, I'll take $1 billion. Well, imagine what we could do with $1 billion.
Well, I had a friend, I won't mention his name, but he was very rich
indeed. Was that friend you, Dad?
Pardon?
Was that friend you?
A friend of mine. And he used to come to our house and he was always moaning about his taxes. And I would say to him, you know, why don't you take my salary and I will pay the taxes. Yeah. You give me what you're making and I would gladly pay your taxes. Oh, no problem.
I actually declare all my income. So if you hand me cash for an acting class, I declare that. If you hand me cash for karate, I declare that. And the reason is simple, is because I believe that I create a deprivation mindset if I have to hide money so that I don't pay tax. So now I'm limiting my income because, ooh, if I made, I don't know what the number is, 70 grand, I'm in a new tax bracket. But again, it's a marginal tax bracket. But also, I want to flourish, thrive, and be so abundant that I need tax solutions. And I think that, you know, that I've been broke as an adult. It was dreadful nipping and tucking to try and avoid a tax. I'd rather be so abundant that I have tax problems.
Well, the thing is that the very, very rich, they don't have tax problems because they've got accountants who find ways in order to defeat it. For example, if you look at the tax code, one of the great ones I've always been amused by and horrified by, oil depletion.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be that billionaires were associated with oil, Texas oil,
sure,
that kind of
steel
thing.
And oil.
Steel and oil, Saudi Arabia. And yet what happened is they managed to get laws passed by government saying that the more oil that they took out, the more money they got because they were depleting their own source of wealth. So, I mean, can you beat it? I mean, it's incredible. Yep.
I love that.
Yep.
It's like double dipping. Okay. So now let's touch on the third, because that we actually just hit on the boomer. We hit on the billionaire. Here's the big one. And to you Americans listening, this may not make a ton of sense to you. Don Cherry got fired because he said, you people, referring to immigrants, aren't wearing poppies and you should wear poppies because you love every part about us, but you're not grateful. He got fired. A, should people have to wear poppies? B, what do you think about a guy like Don Cherry, arguably a boomer, getting fired?
Well, I think that people wear poppies if they feel like wearing it. I mean, I don't have a poppy because I wasn't out. But if you feel like putting on a poppy, absolutely, to remember the dead, to remember those who fought heroically for their country, rightly or wrongly. And then about Don Cherry, it was time. I'm glad he's fired. He should have been fired 20 years ago.
I don't disagree.
He was given a public platform by the CBC, Rogers, the various people who were behind him. And for years, he has ranted against anything which he considered not to fit his categorization, which was ignorant, prejudiced, xenophobic, every word that you could think in the book, and he was allowed to flourish there. It was ridiculous. He should have been fired 20 years ago.
Don't disagree. Where do you think there's a dovetail between, again, I know my answer on this, freedom of speech versus him being fired?
Well, the thing is, there's freedom of speech, but you know where it stops? I mean, the old cliche, when you're in a cinema, you are not allowed to shout fire.
Yeah.
And you could plead any amendment you like to whatever constitution you like. You're not allowed to do that.
Right.
Don Cherry, in the privacy of his own house, to his long-suffering wife or whoever, can say these things, but to give him a public platform paid for by taxpayers' dollars to spout his venom, that is where freedom of speech stops.
Well, I absolutely agree. And where I was going to say my answer is, because this came when, Facebook or Twitter are looking at diminishing advertising that's political, et cetera, et cetera, and people cry censorship. I'm like, it's a private company. Well, it's a publicly held company, but it's a company. They get to impose their own rules and regulations. I can't, when I'm representing Netflix, go and say whatever I want on the airwaves. I can in terms of free speech. It doesn't mean I'm free from consequences of free speech.
Exactly.
And I think that's the big, especially the right wing, they all cry censorship. And it's like, no, you can say what you want. There just will be consequences. Well, He's not in jail or shot.
No.
He just lost his job because the company said no.
Well, we have to remember that Canada has laws about hate speech.
Yeah.
And for hate hate speech, you can go to jail.
Exactly.
And the lawyers will turn around and say, sorry, buddy, you can't do that. Don't you know, it's a crime.
That's right.
You can't hit a person in the middle of the street on the jaw. You can't get drunk in the middle of the street. There are certain things that are crimes. One of them is hate speech.
Yeah.
So, Cherry, you are fostering hate speech. Sorry.
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. Okay, by the way, so we've got a lot of questions today, and I just love using the questions, Dad, as a springboard into our conversation. Mm-hmm. So Andrew Boyd, who asked a question last week, has another one for you. And, a lot of these, if you're listening, they tend to circle the same ballpark. And one of my favorite things when I'm listening to podcasts is the familiarity you get with the people you're listening to. And so we will be touching on some stuff, I'm sure, through these questions, but I kind of like it. It creates a little bit of a theme for us. So from Andrew Boyd, hey, Andrew, how's it going? Advice from Eugene for guys like you and I, me and him, living the next 45 years. So we're 44, and then we're going to live another 45 years, if not more. What do you feel is important for us to focus on and why?
I think what you focus on is the advantages that you have.
Mm.
You know, we can turn around and say we don't have the pensions that they used to offer, that kind of thing. But, you know, there's a multiplicity of avenues that open up. I'm thinking of, and here, you know, far better than I do, but as I look at it, take actors, you know, there are many, many, many more opportunities for actors now, it seems to me, because of the various ways in which actors can show off their talents. There used to be there were a couple of three or four big studios in Hollywood who dominated it. Now, when those people had contracts like the Robert Taylors, the Marlene Dietrich we've talked about, etc., they were secure for life. But these were small cliques that were very often. Nowadays, with the opening up of it, all those kind of safeties, valves that were there, they've been blown away.
Sure.
So you have a certain kind of freedom, a dangerous freedom, if you like.
It's a dangerous freedom. And by the way, this goes to something we chatted about on one of the previous podcasts, Dad, and we slightly disagreed.
Yep.
And I'll tell you why. Because, for example, actors in the 90s had something called a quote. So if you were an actor like me, let's say I was 44 in the 90s, my quote would be about 8 to possibly even 10 times as much as it was when I was 20.
Yep.
Currently, I have to fight to get paid the same amount as I was getting paid when I was 25. Now, the reason is simple. Because of the digital outlets, which is what you're talking about, the ease of creating more work, and therefore the proliferation, including Crave, Hulu, Amazon, all these amazing things. But what happens is twofold. One is none of them have actually the viewership that something like a Seinfeld or a Friends or those shows. They'll probably never be something that gets 60 million viewers that's right. Sitcom again.
Absolutely.
So you're not getting the advertising revenue. So I am currently shooting more as an actor than I've ever shot in my life, head and shoulders above the rest. And I'm still making the same salary effectively, the same dollar number as I did in 2003, 2004. Now you had inflation. Now you had home prices tripling. So I sort of agree with you. But this actually goes back a bit to the boomer idea, which is I think that, you know, and saying that pensions are gone and there's a multiplicity, I think that's a bit of a that's something we can't glaze over because we did talk in the other podcast about why don't people travel as much
right.
as they'd like.
Yeah.
But the thing is that when you're 45 and you have a pension, you know you can take the 2 weeks.
Yep.
When somebody today is 45, quite literally does not have any job security, there's no such thing as tenure, that vacation could be the difference between, with a family, $8,000 or $10,000 in their self-supported pension. So there's a fear around it. And I think that fear is valid. And so where I thought you were going to go with it is gratitude, which I 100% agree with. And we can chat about that in a moment. But in terms of the multiplicity of ways that, let's say, actors can get their work out, I'm not actually, I believe the content out there is better and the storytelling's better. And this is part two, Dad, real quick. Netflix does 10 episode, 8 episode, 6 episode. They're brilliant for storytelling. They're not brilliant for your salary over the season when we used to do 22 episodes.
Right.
So what do you think of all that?
Well, I agree with what you say because you're in the industry, as they call it, so you know those facts very much. But then I would contrast it with the old days going back. that Hollywood not only controlled the making of their product, yes, films, but they actually controlled the distribution of it.
Right.
That the cinemas they owned, everything was, sure, wrapped up until about somewhere around the 50s when Congress stepped in and said, you can't have the whole,
right,
shebang.
Right.
Which meant that the field for actors was very, very limited.
Very limited.
You had these
very
families.
Very limited.
And, of course, in the films, you saw the same faces coming again and again and again. And so it was a very limited field. Now, it has expanded enormously.
Sure.
And the good thing is that with the expansion, then you had not only the distribution, the film producer not being allowed to own the cinemas, mm-hmm, and the distribution of their films, but new centers for the creation of film sprung up,
yep,
e.g. Vancouver, Toronto.
Yes.
Now, that in terms of Canada was an incredible advance, right?
And that's inarguable. That is that in 2002, 2003, when I was shooting The Associates or Just Cause, yep, they were among 5 shows shooting.
Right.
And now, what are there, 40 productions in Toronto? It is beautiful. It's abundant. So I, yep, agree with you on that level.
You see, the individual actor,
yeah,
can be caught. The general actor, generally speaking, there's a lot more employment, I think, among the actors. At least the opportunities are there.
I don't disagree. Uh-huh. And also for new voices. Because if you and I are Indigenous or we're POC or we're LGBTQ and we haven't traditionally been amplified, yeah, we can create something on our phones, find an audience, and then that gets amplified.
Absolutely.
But let's, yep, take this back to, yep, Andrew's question.
Yep.
So we're 44 years old. Yep. We have another 45 to live minimum. What do you mean by that, taking stock of what you have available?
Well, what I mean is by looking at how much, relatively speaking, how much better it was, and to recognize that life can be better nowadays, partly because of technology, partly because of more opportunity, partly because of, paradoxically, greater, greater freedoms that you can take because of social media, which creates where a local argument about what is right and what is wrong becomes universalized.
Agreed.
Through telephones.
Agreed.
All of that kind of thing. And so it's a much more interesting world than the older world of 30 years ago, in which there was an awful lot of pigeonholing.
Right. Well, see, this is where now I'm glad what we're getting to, because, by the way, I think you all know this, but if you're a new listener, I'm 44, my dad's 91, and this has sprung out of the fact that we have this is literally our dinner conversation you're listening to, although it's 11:50 on a Tuesday morning. Same difference. But this is the joy I get of chatting with somebody who's got that span of existence. Now, when you say it's a much more interesting existence, I love hearing that, because you know what it was like in the 40s and the 60s and the 80s.
Oh.
And I know you've said on the podcast before that this is the most abundant, interesting time in your history.
Well, I mean, if I go back even to the 1950s, 60s, 70s, society in Canada, and I experienced it, was very restricted.
Right.
Emigration was limited. It was it was xenophobic.
Yep.
Jews until the 70s had difficulties getting into the country. Southern Europeans were frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Anglo-Saxon business,
sure,
you know, with the Celtic.
Toronto the good.
Being allowed in. And it was a boring, boring city.
Yep.
You have no idea. For instance, going out to have a drink, you had beer parlors in which men only could go in there, no women.
Yeah.
So when you went in for a,
yeah,
beer, no women. And why were there no women in there? Because
you were in a gay bar and you didn't realize it.
No.
Okay.
because
I know some of my listeners are like, that sounds like a gray bar.
No, No. It was because if there are women in there, that was an inducement to sin. There could be,
right,
you know, adultery. There could be fornication.
That's the
in
point.
In that particular place. So you don't allow
That's
women
the point
to get in there.
Out for a drink.
Can you imagine the kind of legislators those are giving in to who was running the place? I mean, narrow-minded,
yeah,
churches. So that kind of thing dominated the the entire thing. At the moment, I'm just getting ready to read something from a great writer who just died recently, Graham Gibson. Mm-hmm. The novel is called Five Legs.
Dear friend of yours.
And Five Legs is an exposure of what he saw at the time of the absolute smugness and hypocrisy of Ontario at that particular time, which was the late 1950s, early 60s. And indeed, it characterized the society. You know, people still drank as much. People still enlisted love, all those sort of things. But you covered up, etc.
Right.
To get drink, you had to sign documents to pick up a case of beer. If you were in your own garden and people could phone in and say, they're drinking openly in their garden. I mean, that's not freedom.
That's not freedom.
No. You're living in a morally repressive society.
Right. Yeah, and you know, growing up in your household with mom as well, I also find that repugnant.
Yeah.
Part two of Andrew's question, we have touched on this, so I'm going to qualify it. What are you most proud of as a father, as a grandfather? He said, not sure you've covered this in past episodes. He's heard about half of each episode. So I know you've answered what you're most proud of, which is family.
Yeah.
But let's exclude family. And you can make it a relatively brief answer. Aside from family, which we know is what you're most proud of, what are you most proud of?
What I'm most proud of is that I've always, my teaching, I'm very proud of the years that I spent teaching and having interchange with young people, whether they were, as I taught at the beginning, children of 4, 5, and 6 years of age, or later on, graduate students doing MAs, PhDs, and that kind of thing. That was wonderful there. And the other thing I'm proudest of is that I've always been interested in examining ideas.
Yeah.
You know, and I still do, actually. The latest one I've been thinking about is the relationship of free will to destiny.
Yes. Let's talk about this, because I know some of your thoughts on it. Go on.
Well, the one I was thinking about, curiously, came up last week, although it has been there for a number of years intermittently, was an extraordinary figure, the figure of Judas Iscariot.
Okay.
Do you know?
I don't know much about it, Dad. You're going to have to educate all of us.
Well, Judas Iscariot, he's the one, you know, we say a Judas figure, you know, a betrayer.
Yep.
And he was the one of the apostles, who betrays Jesus Christ.
Yes.
And as a result of his betrayal, Christ, who is in Christianity seen as the God-man, is taken and crucified.
And that's Judas's kiss.
Tortured. And that's the Judas kiss, you know, which we know of. And that he then, that he condemns Christ to be crucified and where he dies. Now, when I was thinking about him, I thought, what an extraordinarily interesting character he is, normally held up as being the evil one. And in fact, afterwards, he went off contritely and hung himself. And then it says in the Bible that his intestines all fell out.
Okay.
And this was a dreadful fate for Judas Iscariot. But you know, when you think of it, that he had to have done what he did. And you say, well, how could that be? Well, in the grand scheme of things, if you look at Christianity, it always says that the great, demonstration of God's love for us is that he gave his own son to use his blood to wash away our sins.
Yes.
And there are so many hymns we know, Amazing Grace, all of these things that celebrate that. But it could not have happened without the agency of the traitor.
Right.
Judas Iscariot. So should we say that Judas was actually a saint in that he gave his life to bring about what we see as something.
I love that turn of phrase, Dad.
As what we see as being dreadful. Normally he is a scum. He's scum. He's held up as a Jewish scum.
What's worse? I mean, we watch mob movies, and to rat or betray is the ultimate sin that we all agree with.
The ultimate. And so you turn around and you say, but he had to do what he had to do. And did he had total free will, we say.
Yeah.
But did he? If in the grand scheme of things, he had to do that in order to bring about the Christian providential thing. So it's the mystery of that, that, for instance, we're talking about ideas. Mm-hmm. And so I've been, you know, going over that in this last little while. But as I say, it's been an intermittent thought about that particular figure.
Well, I love that thought. I'm going to sit on that myself. But I have a practical question for you. When you're doing this, are you sitting in a chair? Are you looking up a reference material? How are you meditating on this?
No, I'm not looking up any reference material because, I mean, I may if I decide to write something about that. It could be an essay, you know, etc. No, as I'm thinking, maybe going to bed at nighttime, as I'm, you know, beginning to nod over, ideas come to me, and so I think through that there. The other one, of course, is in the very same line, the Garden of Eden.
Okay.
There they are. And, of course, we say that Adam and Eve had the gift of free will.
Sure.
And then we say, gift? What sort of a gift is this?
Well, you said it even earlier, the dangerous freedom of somebody in the digital age.
And, you know, that here they turn around and they commit a sin, you know.
Yep.
Eating the apple, which is merely symbolic. Eve does that, and then Adam does that after her. And that's a sin. But the curious thing is the church, when it looks at that, it calls it the felix culpa, the Latin meaning the happy, wonderful sin or fault.
I didn't know that's what they called it.
The felix culpa. Because with that sin, you now put in motion the whole, how would I say, cycle of Christian history. Because as a result of that sin, you bring about then the descent to this earth, again, of Jesus Christ, who liberates us, and that unhappy story ends up with Christ's love being manifest, and then comes, at the end, Revelation, the last book in the Bible, which you can read as literally true for those who believe in Christianity, or as merely being symbolic or mythic. You see, and Revelation really means apocalypse, you see. And so where did it all begin? With a sin, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
The happy fault.
Well, by the way, Dad, I'm hearing this and I love this and I'm personalizing it so that it's relevant to my day and not just academic. If we call my most recent original sin, my alcoholism, that caused a descent, that caused essentially an expulsion from what had at that time been a version of an Eden.
Yep.
It was only from that that I was actually able to flourish into a human existence, i.e. not detached from humanity, and then fundamentally find an ease and a growth through the real world to a heavenly existence on the earthly plane.
Well, we've talked about this before.
You know, I believe that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you believe that. And it's true in your case. And I think that in so many human lives, that pattern of the Edenic existence, you know, the happy existence, and then the fall in which through drugs, through unfaithfulness, through alcoholism, through various forms of sin, not in a theological sense, but in a breaking of rules that have to do with things like loyalty, blah, 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 that so many people go through that. And then what happens, hopefully, in many, many cases, they manage to get through that dark period and into some kind of light.
Yeah.
And this is what we talked about, the nox obscura, the dark night of the soul, or just simply, you know, let me put it in a totally different way, putting your act together.
Yeah,
you
know, absolutely. Well, it's funny.
Being responsible.
My ex-girlfriend and now friend Lacey Phillips, who, if you're listening, does a wonderful manifesting workshop online called To Be Magnetic. And
I think very highly of Lacey. Yeah,
wonderful woman. And my friend Jess came over one day and was like, oh my God, I just heard this wonderful woman, Lacey Phillips, on a podcast. And she talks about how she kind of only trusts, I'm paraphrasing, by the way, addicts who have recovered, because people who haven't truly hit a bottom, A, still have too much to lose, so there'll always be a potentially shady part of their character, and B, an addict who recovers but doesn't relapse no longer fears, let's say, starting over, so they're less risk-averse. Yep. And I thought that was interesting, because that touches on the same idea.
Exactly.
That once you hit, quote-unquote, a bottom, you're expelled from heaven, you have to re-find everything.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm. So I like where you're going at.
Yeah. Well, you see, again, is that I who was lost am found again. You know that line?
Sure.
It's from Amazing Grace, sure. I think, somewhere on there.
Before we pivot from this beautifully into the next question, you mentioned teaching and how proud you are of that, one of your greatest achievements. Do you miss it?
I miss the contact with the young men and women. That I love that thing. What I like most profs, the first year when your sort of students were finding that they were, you know, didn't want really to be in English studies, etc., marking all those papers, and you knew, oh my goodness, the bottom 30% was, you know, I like Hemingway because Hemingway's a good writer, and Hemingway's a good writer. I really love Hemingway, and my mother likes Hemingway too.
Yeah.
You know, that's the exaggeration. But reading papers like that time and time again, no one likes that. But the other, seeing students come in, I think, of university teaching now, in grade 13, grade 12, the change within 1 year, because they discover that there is a new environment. They're totally free. No roll calls.
Yep.
The prof is just saying, if he, she is a good prof, I'm not interested in what you look like, whether your hair is green, blue, or yellow, whether you're taking drugs. I'm interested in your mind.
Yes.
That's what we want to cultivate.
Yes.
And then you're being exposed to the great works of the human imagination, which ultimately have to do with liberty, whether it's a scientist or a humanist. You know, a Galileo, a Gates, or a Keats, or a Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about liberty, and the university should be there for that kind of process, and hopefully the ideology of the university allows for that.
Yeah. To be honest, this is my favorite podcast yet, Dad, partly because this is really how we get into it all, and I also can see us really climbing the ranks of the comedy on this one. But no, getting back to the idea of the things you met on the thoughts you have for yourself, that kind of thing. Lynn Schmidt, do you remember Lynn Schmidt? She was one of Orm's best friends from the park crew back when we were like 9, 11, 12. So Lynn's a big fan of the show. I'll read you something nice she wrote. Looking forward to you two doing the next pod, as you like to call it. My dad calls it a pod. Love these, inspiring and beautiful. Really love number 3, adventure, mysticism, letting yourself off the hook, stoicism, getting it done, and recounting Eugene chatting with us kids. Love. Yeah. So I said, great. Well, do you have a question? And she said, yep. After hearing about his travels and wanderlust in episode 3, what remains burning on Eugene's desire list? Anywhere he'd want to see again today with fresh eyes? Let's start with that one. Anywhere you want to see again with fresh eyes?
Let me see. Yes. I would love to see Egypt again with fresh eyes. Yeah. I was there with Renata, of course, and we saw Egypt. And I don't know why, but always I've been so impressed by the art of Egypt.
Huh.
It is, I find it a strange thing to say, and I'm not an art historian, but I find the art of the Egyptians so extraordinarily inventive, so extraordinarily fine, that even Greek art seems to be a little coarse compared to it. And also, I think, and this is something I've been thinking about recently too, the most extraordinary person in a woman in ancient times for me, there are a number of them, but the most extraordinary one is Cleopatra.
Yeah.
I mean, that what an extraordinary creature that if you look at all the other civilizations, England, Europe, Asia, I have not come across any female figure that has the same power, except for the Virgin Mary in Christianity.
Sure.
But I'm talking about taking it away from the mythic qualities and the religious associations around the Virgin Mary, that Cleopatra is the most extraordinary creature, lover of two great emperors, you know, Julius Caesar and Antony, you know, giving her life, you know, having an asp there to, you know, to commit suicide because of love. I mean, an extraordinary woman. So that's where I'd love to go back again to have.
And we're sure you're not just in love with Elizabeth Taylor?
No, man.
Fancy yourself a bit of a Richard Burton, do you?
I don't see. I never was very impressed by Liz very much in that. There was another one called Colbert.
Okay.
Colbert, whom I thought was better, but that's all
okay,
right.
Okay, yeah. Well.
That was a movie just about 1932.
Okay, great. So Egypt, I love that. And Greek art, of course. I love that. He's already so accomplished. Does he have a desire list? I'll just finish this. The things he's seen are incredible, and you and Norm are so lucky to have him doing these things to listen years from now. It's awesome. Agreed. So anyways, aside from just the travel, which you mentioned, desire list. You know, I remember once, by the way, to the listener, I was in a particularly flush time, and my dad always liked the 1980s Mercedes convertibles. And you were probably in your 70s at this point. And I said, Dad, I want to get you one of these. It's great for me. It's an investment because they'll never go down in value. But let's go get you one. And you just said, no, I'm not that into it. I don't want that anymore. I wanted it at your age, not at mine. Yeah. What do you still desire at your age?
What I would love to have is the energy to carry out more creative work.
Okay.
That you need to write a book or a play. You know, you're looking at a couple of years, really.
Yeah.
And to have the energy to continue doing that, that I would like to have. And unfortunately, with age, that begins to diminish.
Sure.
So I'd like to have a renewal of that
if I can
find the fountain of youth again.
So to the listener, beware, because at age 91, when you're in the week of your memoir being launched, and you're working on, two operas right now?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That you will begin to feel that wane a little bit. So, by the way, I forgot to ask you this earlier when we were talking about the digital media versus the old school output mechanisms. To anyone listening, today's Tuesday, Thursday night from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Ben McNally Books in Toronto, which is 366 Bay Street, is the launch of my dad's book, The Symmetry of the Tiger. And that was effectively the impetus for this because he writes his memoir. It's his life. And it's interwoven with Canadian politics, Canadian creative output, his own journey from Ireland in 1928 to Toronto now through Guelph, all his world travels. So come on out. I'll be there. My brother will be there. You'll be there. And then there'll be whoever wants to come and say hi and all that kind of thing. How would your book launch have looked in 1965?
Well, actually, how would it have looked? I'm not quite sure what you mean
My belief is, and maybe it's a leading question, is there would have been a bigger launch, more of a press push, because there were fewer publication houses, and therefore it'd be more of a fete.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas we're going to have a lovely launch, but it's not quite that thing.
No. Actually, I did have one other launch before.
Yes.
Most of the books I brought out didn't have a launch. But
they were more academic.
There was one, an academic book, which was The Oxford Companion to Canadian Theatre.
Okay.
And when that came out, I said to my co-editor, whose name is Len Colley, I said, we should really launch this book in a theatre.
Okay.
Well, he agreed. He said, wonderful idea. What do you think? And I said, I will get in touch with Ed Mervish. And so I wrote to Ed Mervish,
yep.
And I said, we've got this wonderful book, and could we use one of your theaters to have a launch party there? And he said, send me the entry on the Royal...
I love this.
It is true.
Of course he did.
I've never told the story before. The Royal Alex. So we sent him an entry, and it was a good entry, very praiseworthy, because one could say negative things, you see, about it being merely a roadhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he liked what he read, and he
That's the word on the street. It's just a roadhouse.
So he read it and said, okay, and he wrote back and said, absolutely. So here we had the Royal Alex, I think it was 1985, about November, and we had a whole bunch of people there, had champagne, etc.,
yep.
And we launched the Oxford Companion to Canadian Theatre. Up to that time, the question had been, when we were working on it, now it was written by hundreds of scholars
mm-hmm.
from all across
mm-hmm.
Canada, is there such a thing? You know, people would say...
Canadian Theatre.
Canadian
yep.
Theatre, say, what? With this book actually was about 600-700 pages
yep.
with a big index, because it dealt not only with plays, but with actual theatres. In other words, how big were the theatres? What kind of audiences went there?
Sure.
What were the special features associated with it? One of the great ones was that when you went to the theatre, you were never quite sure if you'd get home again, because fires were always breaking out. So it was a dangerous occupation, yep, being interested in art and all of that kind of,
sure,
thing. So that was a great launch in the Royal Alley Theatre.
I love that. But even that was self-motivated, which is, yep, let me go back to the boomer question, because I actually agree with you more than I've suggested, because one of the things that people slag off about the boomers is the idea of just go knock on doors, just go drop off your resume. This is how I've gotten every job in my life, except for my lifeguarding and camp jobs, where I would just go down to Toronto Image Works when I was 35 years old, 60 grand in debt, and I just introduced myself to the manager. This is recently, by the way. This isn't even 10 years ago. This is like 8 years ago. And I just said, I need a job. Are you hiring? She said, not really. Maybe try back. Next week, went down. How about now? Do you have anything opening up? And then finally, she goes, why don't you come back in 2 weeks? Come back in 2 weeks. Get the job. This is how I've gotten every photo client I've ever gotten, is by effectively cold calling people I know, but, yeah, going, hey, do you need new headshots? My acting classes, I solicited people by going, come take my acting class, come take my acting class. So I actually believe that, you know, that self-starting, that initiative idea is so fundamental, and we're hyper-socialists sitting here.
Well, actually,
you did this with your launch at the Ed Mervish Theater. You literally said, yeah, I want to do a launch, yep, at the Ed Mervish Theater, and then next thing you know, you're in the Ed Mervish Theater genuinely launching a massive compendium to Canadian theater.
Exactly. And, you know, there are jobs out there. You know, it's hard to believe, but at the moment, that in the aviation industry, they're going to need, over the next 10 years, about 30,000 pilots.
Right.
They don't have them.
Yeah.
And so the opportunities there,
yeah,
now, of course, you have to be, training is very rigorous,
sure,
but there are so many places. And if you sit and expect the job to come to you,
right,
not in the competitive market nowadays,
yeah,
and I've always been a socialist NDP, always have been, because that's really the old labor union idea. But the best of labor socialism is a combination of capitalism and,
you know, I agree.
Yeah,
you know,
and,
I agree.
You know,
yeah,
state intervention, yeah, to help poor people, old people, all that
now,
kind of thing.
The only caveat I want to give to all this is that I am extremely privileged, being born a white, handsome man who has an intellect that was God given. Not, I mean, I didn't work that hard to learn the things I learned up until age 20. Since, yes, but up till then, no. And I walk in and I'm sort of the right guy for the job a lot of the time. And that's the one I can never speak to and never want to pretend to speak to. But I will say this, when you're 35 years old, the humility of having been on magazine covers, having been on billboards, having been on TV nightly, and having to go scrounge for a minimum wage job and getting one, it does involve an insane amount of humility and stick-to-itiveness that I wish I, at that time, didn't have to have employed. But now I'm so grateful I had to have employed it.
Well, actually, you're absolutely right. And I mean, you were following in my footsteps. My job, when I came back from Mexico after working,
right,
on a novel down there, what was my first job in Toronto? Working in Fran's restaurant.
Yeah.
That chain is still,
yeah,
here. And I was a dishwasher. I went in at 10 o'clock at night and I got back to my apartment at 6 o'clock in the morning washing dishes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
again, you're working at Remington Rand, what's effectively a $100,000 a year job.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You quit it to go write a novel in Mexico. We're recapping last podcast.
Right.
And then you come back to Toronto, and this is part two,
yep,
is that you have no money.
No money.
You have to,
no,
work as a dishwasher,
yep,
midnight shift.
Yep.
I love,
exactly,
that. You know, I love that because, you, yep, know, I love the blend of it all.
Yep.
Of course, there's, again, I'm only speaking to white dudes because I can't speak for anyone else. Or honestly, I can tell stories that other people may enjoy, but I don't know what barriers other people have, and I'd never pretend to. But I do know that the barriers in my life were always overcome by humility and the ability to work within the real world, not my fantasy world.
Well, when I look at, for instance, in Toronto and, you know, my students, etc., and I look at the students that went out from, say, Indian background, Pakistani background,
mm-hmm,
Chinese background, and so on, so many of them have done so well. And I meet at convocation, I would meet their parents, and some of the parents, their English, you know, but they could hardly speak English, but they,
yeah,
had worked hard to put their children into, give them a good,
yeah,
education. And suddenly their children, now young men and women, were getting great jobs,
yes,
and going out there and doing wonderfully.
Uh-huh.
So it can be done. It's not a question of once upon a time you did these things. You could still do it every day.
Yep.
There are people who are, and you don't have to be saying, well, it's somebody is successful because they're now making $250,000 a year. They can be very successful in making themselves a good home and creating a decent lifestyle.
Sure, and I think that's a bit of what social media does, is it says until you hit X, you're not successful, and then it creates an inbuilt depression.
Yep.
By the way, I want to go back to the Don Cherry thing. I've been a little quiet on this one because I wanted to know your opinion, but I want to add to the fuck you, Don Cherry. I'm shooting a movie right now with a woman who had to flee Syria, like literally bombed, war-torn, fled it, like lost everything she'd built, left some family there, fled to Canada 2 years ago. I'm shooting a film with her right now. She's playing one of the women in the movies. Lovely woman. And I love the idea that if she doesn't wear a poppy, that she doesn't understand the sacrifice of war. Because someone like Don Cherry, who's never fucking been to war, has the gall to tell her how she needs to represent freedom. She understands sacrifice more deeply than anybody who hasn't served in terms of what war does, by literally being caught in a war, being bombed, losing her entire life, her way of life. And then if within 2 years of being in Toronto, she doesn't wear a poppy, she doesn't understand the sacrifice that someone who never sacrificed apparently understands better than her. Fuck that.
Yep.
That's just so egregiously wrong.
Yep.
And shows such a lack of understanding of not everybody, but why so many people, especially Syrian refugees to Canada, come. They're literally in a war that we've never felt, that we've never had to lose or experience. And then people who are sitting around going, oh, fuck you, wear a fucking poppy if you love Canada. Mm-hmm. It's like, love Canada, it's a life raft for her.
Yeah.
Love is about the fact that she's clinging on for dear life to her life.
Absolutely. Well, that's the other thing. That's the other thing, where people coming from other countries are at a disadvantage, because the whole cultural, background of Canada is missing for them.
Yeah.
So when they take examinations in history or even literature, many of them are Muslim or Hindu, and the grammar of that we have here is really, it's based on the Bible with all its magnificent stories and metaphors and so forth. And that's what we draw upon when we are studying Milton, Paradise Lost, the novels of James Joyce, etc., etc.
The King James Version of the Bible.
Yeah. No, they don't have that.
Correct.
So they have to learn a whole mythology, although they have a magnificent theology. The theology, for instance, the myths of Iran, Persia, are fantastic.
They're fantastic.
I mean, all of these sort of stuff.
I've only scratched the surface, and it's brilliant stuff.
The indigenous people of North America, all of that's there, but they have to fit in to this Procrustean bed, which is Anglo-Saxon tied back to the Grecian Christian stuff.
And I don't want to spend forever on this, but it's so inherently racist, because look, you and mom raised me European.
Yep.
You did not raise me Canadian, because you're not Canadian. You guys moved here in your mid-20s, you know, that kind of thing. Of course you raised me European. That's what you knew. Imagine you're listening and you're 26 and you move to another country. You're going to raise your kids with a Christmas tree or a this or that, or assuming that's what you do.
Yep.
And then I'm Canadian. You and mom are immigrants and you are Canadian, but I think there has to be, when you're white and you're attractive like you and mom, nobody really minds. It's exotic and it's great. But when you're colored, I believe that's where people start going, you people need to this. Anyways, I don't want to get on it, because we could go down a real rabbit hole of like, but it really is. And that's where I think people miss how inherently racist what he said is, is because he wouldn't say that to you and mom.
But he's been saying it all along.
I know he has.
Gays, you know.
Women in locker rooms. My friend Stevie from LA, she has a question for you. Love this question. Do you believe in love at first sight?
Yes.
Go on.
Absolutely.
Go on.
It happened to be.
Is that why I'm here, Dad?
That's why you're here. Happened to be, well, actually, my first love was an Irish girl, and met her in a club in London, England. It was love at first sight.
Yep.
And then when that didn't work out, I then later on met the lady who became my wife, Renata, and that was love at first sight. Went to one party, and at the end of that party, that was it.
You just knew.
The next day I said to her, you know, let's go out for an outing tomorrow morning. And that night, I said to her, yep. I said, where do you want to go? I said, Niagara Falls.
Okay, and of course, bold.
Niagara Falls, of course, as you know, was the home, the place where all the honeymoon couples went to. And that was it. I do believe in love at first sight.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean to say that you can't have a wonderful marriage founded upon something that isn't that instantaneous,
sure,
romantic kind of thing. But there is something to that love at first sight, that attraction that you say, I want to see that person again.
Sure.
And it's irrational. But then if we say it's irrational, it has to be. Well, because as we said before,
sure,
you buy a car when you're rational. You don't, you know, buy into a marriage if you're rational. You're in love. You've fallen. That's why we say you fell in love.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about the other type that you haven't experienced, but William James in his Varieties of Spiritual Experiences
right.
talks about this, where there's your blinding white light experience, but there's also your spiritual experience of the educational variety.
Yep.
And that's, in fact, in terms of my relationship with what I call God,
yep.
that's been a educational variety, where quietly over time, through making the choice to have mm-hmm. a faith,
yep.
I have found the faith to be true for me. That wasn't I didn't fall out of bed one day and hit my knees and go,
no.
Oh my God, this is a real thing for me. So I actually believe in both kinds,
well,
but I definitely believe in love at first sight.
You go back to one of the ideas that I'm always after, this idea of destiny.
Sure.
You know, we turn around and say, the two people have nothing to do with it. You know, the older people sit and look at the two young people mooning over each other and say, it was a match made in heaven.
Right.
They say, they had nothing to do. It was made up in heaven.
Right.
And you'll find that in so many mythologies. They had nothing to do with it.
Well, I know you believe that. And her second question, and by the way, we had this sort of before, but it was Canadian. Top three favorite books. Don't think about it. Just go. Three favorite books.
Well, one of them, for instance, let me see. I Told You was The Handmaid's Tale.
Yep.
Now, then, if it's three favorite books, Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, yes. I know you love that one.
I love that particular book. And then, of course, here I cheat a little bit, but The Collected Plays of Shakespeare.
Wow. That's not a cheat.
That's wonderful. No, in heaven, I want to sit between two people. One of them is Jane Austen, and the other is Chaucer.
Oh, wow.
Chaucer. That's,
yeah?
Yep.
Yeah. Do you want to go that far back? Are you going to be able to understand him?
Well, the question, will he understand me with my Irish accent?
Yeah, right? I love that, Dad. Okay, so we're winding down here. So let's go to Cousin Oliver.
Oh, yeah.
So Oliver is my cousin through my mom's sister. Haida's son, and then Oliver, he's visited Toronto many times. We've seen him over in Germany. And so he has a question for us. By the way, Oliver, nice to hear from you. Ich freue mich sehr auf von deinen E-Mail. Und Oliver said to us some very nice things, which I won't read, but he's very much enjoying the podcast. And his question is this. As you both are world travelers and have seen different places and met many people from different cultures, religions, can you agree to the following? I have found that most of the people, no matter where they live on this planet, basically long for the same things. So, Dad, can you and I agree that most people on the planet long for a loved one, partner, friend they can trust, count on, and socialize?
Yes.
100%.
100%.
I think that's the point of it all.
That's the point of it all, yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, go on.
That's the thing about travel. We have traveled a lot and seen that.
Exactly.
And the same, you know, human desires and wishes are very, very much the same. And Oliver, who is a world traveler because he represents a great German steel company, he's always in China, Russia, etc. So he would have seen exactly the same thing. Yep.
Yeah, and no I remember question. When Emily and I parted ways, and, you know, it was a lovely, deep moment. And I said, look, Emily, you know, you being younger and not having, quote-unquote, traveled as much. Of course she has, but what I believe that you don't believe yet is that it's all just about a cup of tea with a friend at the end of the day.
Yep.
As long as our basic needs are met, that's the one, again, Maslow's hierarchy. You know, you have to feel comfortable enough with no socioeconomic anxiety beyond reason. But once you're kind of okay and your rent's paid, for me, it's just tea with a friend can mean romance. Tea with a friend can mean karate. But for me, that socialization and that connection with friends and lovers, and family and you. That's all there is. That's the whole fucking point of it to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can give you personal examples. When I taught at university, especially first-year students, here they would come from little villages, small towns throughout Ontario or maybe throughout Canada, and I would meet them in my office. And at the beginning, now and again, you'd meet a student who was simply lost. And when I'd chat to that student, be a young man, a young woman, they were lonely. But what would happen? The next time I'd see them, they were okay. Just like all the rest of them. And what was the magic? What thing had happened to them? They'd found a friend.
A friend. It makes me so emotional. It's beautiful.
One friend was all they needed.
All you need.
That this huge buildings around them, you know, which they'd never seen that kind of thing, weren't used to it. Suddenly, they had one friend. It was okay.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, I teach acting and... The greatest compliment, and it's not overtly a compliment, that I've ever gotten from acting students, and a number of them, isn't, oh, this is the best acting class. Oh, you're blah, blah. It's nothing to do with me. It's, I felt lonely in Toronto until I started taking your class.
Yeah.
And now I feel like I have a group and a connection to this city. And that just makes me well up because if I can provide that, an acting concept, you can find it online. But you can't find it with a group of people on a Sunday night who are working through, who have the same hopes and fears as you, and put yourself on the line in a trusting manner. It's beautiful. Then you become friends.
Marvelous.
So part two, I actually just touched on this. Do you believe that everybody wants a job that brings in the money to do whatever they want or need to do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, I think I've quoted before Henri Bergson, the French philosopher, says a statement that took me a long time to understand: man exercises his divinity in labor, meaning that you need a job. It's a very interesting statement, isn't it?
Yeah.
Man exercises his divinity.
If you've quoted this before, I was maybe looking up another question. I love this. Let's keep going.
Because, you know, if you think of so many people when they retire or when they're coming up to retirement, I've seen this, and they say to me, you know, I'm frightened. I'd say, why? They say, you know, what am I going to do when I retire? Because for 30, 40, 50 years, they'd be going into their office as a medical doctor or as a teacher or as a lawyer or whatever. And they had a place.
Yeah.
They had a foundation.
Yes.
They had friends, associations, all of that. And then with retirement or forced retirement, you know, it used to be 65, suddenly you were out there. So what did you do with yourself?
Yeah.
And in many, many cases, people actually, their lives were shortened through that. I mean, that sounds dramatic, but it was absolutely true in many cases.
When I don't work as an actor, but I have money in the bank, enough to not fear that month financially, the greatest thing that plays upon my psyche is the feeling that I'm not useful or needed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It makes me feel self-pity. It makes me feel lonely. And that's the greatest challenge, is that nobody cares.
Yeah.
I can call a friend or whatever. I'm talking professionally. But there's a validation in society through that work, through the divinity.
Absolutely. So so I would agree. I mean, for Oliver, I would say, yes, we need work, because also the other thing is that, can you think of anything that is that can drive a man or a woman more to extremities if they cannot feed their family, their wife, their children? I mean, if you can't feed them, and then you're driven to desperation. Think of the Great Depression years.
Yeah.
I mean, the gangsters, it flourished, that whole thing, because they needed money, and people would do anything. I mean, you could hire a killer for $25.
Well, and if $25 bucks provides for your family, you can justify it.
Yep.
So I actually want to touch upon that a little, because I don't want to get into that specific study that says 70 grand is the base level of happiness, and at that point it doesn't increase.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make 70 grand, the standard for being able to provide for your family, above that, you're not actually measurably happier.
Yeah.
Arguable, we'll see. But what I will say is that I do think that, again, because of how easy it is to go online and shop for something new, how easy it is to look at a friend in another city who you have no idea how they're feeling. You know, there's this great phrase, don't judge your insides compared to someone else's outsides.
Mm-hmm.
So I see their Instagram photo and they're sitting in a Lamborghini and I go, fuck, I just have a vintage Porsche.
Yeah.
Why do they have a Lamborghini? Why don't I?
Yeah.
I think that's too easy to do these days.
Yeah.
And therefore, the only thing I would add, Oliver, in my opinion, is what someone needs and wants to do can sometimes get inflated above what we actually need and want. It's funny because there's a new guitar I want. I told you this before we started. And I can totally afford it, but I also need winter tires, and it's about the same price to get winter tires for my new truck. And I love the idea that I was once given, I can have everything I want, maybe just not today. Because for me to buy both would financially strap me. Yeah. And I want the winter tires. So now my need is to have a safe drive this winter. My need is not a safe drive this winter and a guitar. And so I think that, and by the way, I've been victim to this in the past, where I think I need both today. And if I don't have both, it's a sense of lack. So the one thing I talked about on the old season of the podcast is not getting what I want is very different from something being taken from me or me being wronged. And that's a big thing I just want to throw out. Maybe not as much to Oliver, but it's a really important idea for me, because sometimes if I don't get I had a friend not get a job recently, and he said, I lost a job. Well, he didn't have the job.
No.
But the feeling is that he lost it because he wanted it. Well, he didn't lose it. And that's something I think we forget sometimes, is we have hopes and dreams. Yep. We can lose the hope and dream, but we can't lose the job we never had.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, sometimes, Hollywood or popular media can pick up on the zeitgeist. One of my favorite lines is, greed is good. And here, here you've got, Hollywood picking up on, greed is good. And what they're saying is you can't have too much.
Right.
And the result is, I see it even with children nowadays with their iPads. Out comes Model 70, Model 72, Model 74, and they've got to have the others.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not because they need it. It's because we have created in them this feeling of the more, the better. Greed is good.
Yeah.
Although these kids are not greedy, but they're being conditioned through Silicon Valley, through Wall Street, through Madison Avenue. More is better. Which is totally wrong.
If enough isn't, more won't be.
Exactly.
This is one of my favorite. Yeah. If this goes on my gravestone, because it's a phrase I never heard before I coined it.
Yep.
If enough isn't, more won't be.
Yep.
And as a guy who's always craving more, I have to remind myself: if you already have enough guitars, more won't be enough. More will just be more.
Yep.
Do you believe that everybody wants to have kids, or if they have kids, to bring them up with education, raise them to be self-sufficient and independent?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about the self-sufficient independent, because obviously you want to bring them up smart but how important is that,
I think it's very important, for example, that the freedom in a family, because the most violence inflicted upon people are inflicted in the family home.
Sure.
Whether it's murder or whether it's emotional abuse or sexual abuse or whatever, it happens in the family. If you look at Greek tragedy, it's not strangers and strangers, It's in the family.
Yeah.
When you look at the whole Oedipus myth, Electra and so forth, it's in the family. And so what you've got, if you could create a healthy family inside where there is freedom, not the picture that we normally have, for instance, in novels and play, well, as I say, the Greek tragedies, the stern father, the repressed mother, all of these archetypal images. If you could have... chat with your children. Let them know what life is about.
Yeah.
For instance, I would never have thought about asking my parents what their salary was.
Right.
That would have been regarded as, breaking all the barriers that, differentiated us.
Sure.
Nowadays, children, you guys were very free to speak with us.
Well, and I remember you not wanting to answer that question with me.
Yeah, probably.
Mom would, and you didn't want to.
I would.
And
that's,
I don't care. But at the time, it was
I was a doctor.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to Oliver. He's got two more questions. Here's an interesting one, because this goes to a bit of what we've talked about, and I know my opinion on it. Do you believe everyone, wherever they are, no matter what, wants to have as good and painless as life as possible?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely. That question seems to be self-evident. Why would we want pain? No.
I differ.
Yeah, you differ.
I do.
Oh,
all my growth has come through pain.
I
don't crave it. I don't want any more of it. But when I think about literally the fundament of martial arts, is that I get hit. I technically get hurt. And from that, I then learn how to behave differently. And from that different behavior, I see it with the kids on my ballet show. I call them kids. They're 20 to 25. And they're in a lot of pain as they're shaping their bodies to do things at a world-class level. And from that then comes the reward. Now, I don't think necessarily relationships have to go that way. I don't think. But I know that within myself, if I go for good and painless, I'm only speaking for me here. So Oliver, again, I don't know about all the people I've met. I think that there's a bit of a soma to looking for good and comfort, but I think that more people engaging directly with their pain, the shadow self, to look at what frustrates them, to feel it, will lead to more growth. And I also think it'll lead to more people taking responsibility, because my pain comes from within, not from without, assuming I'm not being held down and held captive. And therefore, I'm less likely to judge you if I'm more in touch with my own pain, and also willing to, a bit like the Lacey idea, I know more pain is coming. I'm not seeking to avoid it. I'm seeking to grow through it. Like, I'm basically going, God, I know there's trials ahead of me. I just ask that I can walk through it with grace and emerge the other end having learned something. And, well, and by the way, most importantly, and I'm not just saying this, being able to offer to people behind me on the path maybe a way to not step in the muck, because they'll find their own pain anyways. I can't save them, but I can offer them maybe a slightly softer, easier way.
Well, that differs very much from the way I look at it, because again, I look at it from a very broad, maybe I am using the word too easily, existential point of view. Why do we have to suffer pain? You know, that the mystery of pain is what interests me, that I look around me, and in the city we're living in now, Toronto, there's a host of hospitals and homes where people are lying there in pain.
Yes.
Children being born who the mothers die because of the pain. Children die because of pain, and we look at the cancer in a young child of 4 years of age. And so you go through it, and you see that all of that pain being inflicted from somewhere, some source. Why does that have to be?
See,
especially when you go along to church and you're faced with the continual repetition of the all-loving God.
Okay.
And how do you reconcile the all-loving principle that governs the universe with the pain which is essential to it? And to take one particular example which gives me nightmares, the Holocaust, when I think of the pain even before those people were burned to death that they endured. Why?
Okay, so I'm chomping at the bit here, and I literally threw in another lozenge for this, because here's where I don't give a shit. And what I don't give a shit about is not the pain. I care deeply, and I'm deeply empathetic. What I mean is, I don't care why, because it happens. That's like asking, why is a rattlesnake venomous? I don't care. I don't actually care why we suffer pain, because no human on the planet has ever avoided it. So to spend time over there feels a bit platonic meets esoteric, whereas to go, let's just accept that pain is fundamental to our existence, as is joy, as is, you know, whatever we want to call fundamental. But I believe pain is not the fundament, but fundamental, part of the integral nature of being human. We can't avoid suffering. Therefore, my belief is not to try, undo, to know it's coming and to actually be able to walk through the fire.
Right. These positions,
which is slightly different. Yeah,
these positions are not irreconcilable.
I agree.
No.
I actually agree.
That, you see, what you're looking at it is the practical answer to a universe in which pain exists.
Correct.
Period. But what I am saying is, in line with the kind of Greek thinking, is the unexamined life is not worth living.
Sure.
So you say to yourself,
so I want to spend my bandwidth or my time examining how to healthily handle pain.
Yes.
And what to get from it.
But then I draw back further from that. The camera's drawing
and
back.
And you get to with your perspective and age.
And then it says, what is the cause of that pain? Why is that pain so rampant throughout the entire universe?
Sure.
And how do you reconcile that with the concepts that are given to us by many of the religions?
I'm not worried about
world.
That reconciliation either.
Yeah. I know you're not worried about it, but my question to myself is, why? How do you reconcile those two? They say that God is all-loving.
But why does it matter to reconcile what they say?
Because if you live in a world that's a world of contradiction, basically, then that seems to be a rather strange world. You look for an answer as to why.
Do you not think we live in a world of contradiction?
We do. That's
right.
What I'm
so
saying.
Why do we need to reconcile contradictions?
Because I think that's human nature. I think it is the essence of human nature.
Sure, that's another fundament. We've got two contradictory fundaments,
right.
To accept what is
right.
and to probe for why it is
right.
and change it.
Right, I agree.
Okay, I think we've landed on something nice. I actually don't disagree, because the one big thing for me is that I don't think people should seek pain they don't want.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where we get into, I don't mean BDSM, go for that. I mean people seeking out, like they keep replicating a bad relationship. They wonder why they keep ending up with abusive partners. And that's the sort of pain that, but again, it's just going to happen from childhood yeah. programming, et cetera. So it's yeah. not about why do I, well, maybe it is. Maybe unpacking that is important.
See, why a mother, a mother is there and her child is dying in the arms and she says to you, why? She's suffering this terrible pain, losing her child. And what's the answer to that mother? That's just one example.
Sure.
I mean, and then you feel, I got to say something. So you turn around and says, well, God will take care of it. Or, you know, in the afterlife, you know, it'll be all right, et cetera.
Yeah.
But these are totally unsatisfactory answers, you say.
Well, this is something it took me till I was about 35 to be able to say, and I mean that, yeah. I truly mean that, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry.
And that's
something it took me a long time to get to is, yeah. I don't know. That's yeah. one of the most powerful phrases I've ever learned.
And I think that's what philosophy is about, not literature, but philosophy, answering those kind of questions or attempting to.
Last question from Oliver. I think this one we can go out on nicely. In essence, people want peace, not war.
Oh, no question. No question.
Then why is there so much war? Why are we in a never-ending war over there in Afghanistan? Longest war in U.S. history, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's... well, how do you answer that question? When you look at history, it's that whole sense of acquisition, territory, preserving it or adding to it, the warlike instinct in mankind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of those features are there. And take the First World War. I mean, just you know. They discovered there were treaties there that they hadn't been really totally aware of.
Right.
Somebody shot in Sarajevo. Then France discovers it's obliged to go to war and so forth.
Yeah, that was a mess.
And so, total mess. And the ordinary man and woman desires peace.
Agreed.
It is the lords, the war, that's why we call it warlords.
Sure.
These people who are running countries who feel they've got to attack other countries, and explaining is just explaining the mystery of evil, if you can.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just...
Well, I think there's two things. A villain is never a villain to him or herself.
Yep.
And so there's that idea. Once we fight this war, things will be better. And I think that goes to your idea about the depression.
Yep.
Okay, I don't want to go kill somebody, but I need to provide for my family.
Yep.
And I think people get a disproportionate sense of what that looks like. Yep. And I also think, you know, there's a line in one of my favorite movies, Dazed and Confused, where this one guy starts being aggressive with another guy at a party, and he shoves him and he goes, I came here to drink some beer and kick some ass, and it looks like I'm out of beer. And I know that guy. I grew up with that guy. You go to a party in Rockwood at the conservation area, those guys are there. They're going to fight.
Yeah.
They're going out to take their shirt off and have a fight. Those guys want war. However, this is where I agree with you, Dad, entirely. I believe there's a war within themselves that fighting actually quells for the night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think there's something about it. There's a dis-ease within themselves.
Yes.
And by having that fight, everything's so heightened and dynamic and, by the way, painful. And I don't want to psychologize these guys because I don't know their psychology, but I'm imagining their home life wasn't phenomenal,
mm-hmm.
most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they actually get to quiet the home life war within them by having that fight. And I do think that's a big aspect. So I agree with you that people want peace. And even sometimes they fight for peace because it's the only way to quiet the noise.
Well, what you're saying is that it reminds me of that I've read about psychological studies of some of the most famous leaders throughout the world, where they say that a necessary trait that these people must have is that they are psychopaths. Really?
Sure.
That's what they say, that the great leaders are psychopaths. You know, from Alexander right through Hitler, Churchill, the whole bunch of them.
So if I look up the definition of psychopath, by the way, I don't think it's as intense as we think, and that's why I think you're absolutely right. A person suffering from chronic mental disorder with abnormal or violent social behavior. So obviously, you know, I always say when people talk about mental health and guns, I'm like, of course they have a mental health problem. You can't go shoot somebody without having a mental health problem. Unstable or aggressive person. I just don't think it's, I don't think psychopaths are frothing at the mouth and shuffling up to you like Heath Ledger and the Joker. I think that they're people who don't have a stability within them, and they seek it almost like I was chatting about with those young guys, age 16, trying to get in a fight. They're seeking a stability through an intensity of something that will maybe resolve it for them.
Right. The other thing is, too, that one of the very interesting questions is when you look at a nation, is the leader voicing what the nation feels, or is the leader giving the imprint on the nation?
Well, see what I mean? 100%.
Which is it? Is it the leader? I'm not sure. You see, when Hitler was doing his stuff, I'm not sure myself. When Hitler was leading Germany or the Teutonic races there, was he the one who was doing it, or was that all the dirt and the filth and everything welling up and finding a voice in him?
If I give my answer, it's that there's a latency and there's something happening within people that they don't quite know how to name it. You know, you see when people, there's videos every week of somebody being racist and they're literally spewing Donald Trump's words. But those people aren't racist because of Donald Trump.
No.
They were racist, and he gives a language to it. Somebody tweeted this morning, I wish I could find it, but it'd be too long a pause, is racism isn't new or even more in America. No. It's always been there. But what's happening is there's a voice and a freedom to voice it now. And you'll even see with people trending on Twitter saying Don Cherry is right, they're going, great, finally someone we can get behind and rally around who says what I want to say. Well, they already thought that. Don Cherry didn't make them think you people. Those people already look at people of color and go, oh, you people, and see them as separate. And so in any case, I don't think there's a beginning, middle, or end to that, but I do think what a leader does is gives voice to what's there, or at the very least, the freedom to voice what's there within a person.
Right.
Or says, no, we're not that country.
Yeah, well, a great example of this, or a horrifying example, is colonialism. Colonialism, which manifests itself in England, English colonialism, German, Dutch, French, all of these, the great European nations. The colonial was that they went off and they said, we are superior.
Right.
We are bringing you.
Who wouldn't want to be told they're superior and be able to go, oh, great.
Right. Yeah.
I get to have free labor as an American slave owner because I'm superior.
Exactly. And so they went into South America, destroyed the people there.
Yeah.
They had their priests going first, you know, and, you know, under God, we come here with that cross
what
there.
What better defense than I'm doing this for God?
And so the military officer is justified in saying, cut them down.
God's
and
will.
So you had it all over Europe, all these countries.
Although by your argument, it would be God's will, because as with Judas or as with Destiny, I guess it was God's will.
Well, then what kind of a God are we looking at then?
Oh, there's a good question.
So there's the question. You know?
Okay, well, let's leave it at that. What kind of a God are we looking at? Have you enjoyed our chat today, Dad?
Love it. I love it.
I have
it.
Very much. You know, I feel like we got into a bit more minutia about the ideas, but I actually love that. It's one of my favorite things about talking to you.
Wonderful.
Okay, so last shout out this Thursday, November 12th.
November 14th.
November 14th. I hope you didn't just tune out. November 14th, this Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Ben McNally, 366 Bay Street. This podcast is going to keep going. Thank you for listening. We know you love it.
Yeah, come and have a drink and a little bit of food, and I'll sign a book for you.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Wonderful.
If that's not an enticement, I don't know what is. We'll see you there, everybody. Thanks, Dad.
Bye. Thank you, Sean.